Okay, now we are inviting Lalou, but by video transmission and not a live transmission. Frederick Lalou, I think everybody of you knows. He has written this book, Reinventing Organization. He comes from a pure business background. He was partner at McKinsey. And McKinsey does a lot of work in order to make work more intensive, more tight, more rational, organized. And so, in order to introduce Lalou to you, I would like to quote something I got from him when I sent him an email. And I think this quote shows that he always and still is a big innovator inviting us for something new. I quote, "I have started a routine where I work on my emails once a week, and where I accept that might be quite a few emails I will not be able to respond to. If a response takes time to reach you or doesn't come at all, I'm sorry. Please be happy with me, though I'm spending time with my children, with Helen, with new work that feels meaningful, and in regular walks in nature." I think that's a beautiful message of somebody who really tells us how to reinvent our organizations. And now I do hope that the transmission will work. Craig, can you start it?
This is a video recording, yeah, because Lalou just moved to the United States, and now it's around 3 a.m. in there. And he just said he would rather prefer sleep at this time. So he sent a video.
In Hungary. I
just sound check. Oh, yes, what he says. What, courage is the main topic, and I think this fits perfectly with what Terry told us.
Hello, all of you in Hungary. It is probably 2 o'clock in the morning right now, where I live. So I've recorded this video up front, but I'm excited to be here, even if I'm not there live, because I got excited about what I wanted to share with you. I have a page full of scribbled notes, because this is something I haven't talked about in any place yet. And it has to do with some thoughts about evolutionary purpose and courage. I want to talk about evolutionary purpose because I feel that of the three breakthroughs that I talk about in Reinventing Organizations, it's the one that is least understood or most misunderstood. And it's also the one where I feel we still have most to learn, sort of collectively. I feel, you know, self-management, you know, we kind of know how to make that work, and, you know, wholeness, there's no doubt that we know how to create, you know, places where people dare to show up whole. But evolutionary purpose is still very often misunderstood. So very simply, you know, what it is not is simply having a noble purpose, simply having a mission statement. I sometimes read blog posts of organizations who say, oh yeah, you know, think we've done that because look at, you know, we have this noble purpose. If that was the case, then pretty much all nonprofits, say, you know, would, you know, follow an evolutionary purpose, and that's in my opinion not the case. So what is it? Well, it's really this perspective that an organization is like a living organism, that it has its own sense of purpose, that it's its own sense of direction, its own calling, its own energy to go somewhere. Its own thing that it wants to manifest in the world. And so that our role as people in those organizations is not to impose our own will onto the organizations, making strategic plans and saying, hey, you know, we should go in this direction, but is to listen to where this organization wants to go. And that's such a radical perspective that I know that people read this in the book, and many people seem to still, you know, forget about it or not get it. And, you know, maybe this perspective is interesting, is that most artists get this immediately. You know, the number of people, I don't know, songwriters who talk about the fact that a song came to them. Right? I was out there in the garden in the field and suddenly the song came to me and I run because I needed to scramble it before, you know, before it was too late, because then the song would leave me again. Right? So it seems like songs, you know, are out there somewhere and then they come to us. The most amazing example I've seen of this was in Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic. It's a wonderful, profound, but funny book on living a creative life. And in that book, she tells this amazing story where at some point, you know, there's this idea of a book that comes to her. She's completely engrossed in it, and she starts researching. And the book is a very peculiar book. It was inspired by a story that in the Amazon in Brazil in the 1960s, there was this ridiculous scheme of trying to build like this huge highway and this whole infrastructure into the jungle. And of course, the jungle was stronger, and within no time, the jungle took over and that whole project failed. And she was so inspired by that story that, you know, she had this whole book, and it was about a CEO of a construction firm disappearing into the jungle, you know, with his whole project, and he never comes back. And his secretary, you know, a woman who'd never left the Midwest in the United States, who was secretly in love with her boss, decides to go to the Amazon to try to find him. And that's sort of the whole story. And it turns out that at some moment, Elizabeth Gilbert has an issue in her personal life, which means that she cannot write that story for a while. So for 2 years, she puts this whole thing, you know, on pause, deals with other stuff in her life, and then she's so happy because she finally can go back to writing that story. And as she goes back to researching and writing this, she realizes, you know, the idea is gone. There's no more energy. I mean, yeah. So she stops, gives up, and, you know, moves on to another project. And a year later or so, she meets another very famous writer. I think her name is Anne Pritchett. And they become instant friends, and they talk about their project. And this other famous writer tells her, oh, you know, I have this amazing story about the Amazon jungle. And it's exactly the same book. I mean, not exactly. In her case, it's not a construction firm, it's a pharmaceutical firm. But it's the CEO of a pharmaceutical firm that goes into the jungle, gets lost, and it's a secretary from the Midwest who is secretly in love with him, who goes to the jungle to find him. And these two women stare at each other and like, whoa. You know, it seemed like, that's at least how, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert talks about it. This idea that came to her at some point became impatient, said, well, listen, if you're not going to write the book, you know, I'm going to find myself somebody else to write it. And that story is amazing, and it's almost unbelievable, except that, you know, ask artists, and they all have that sort of experience. And so I believe that it's the same with organizations. I believe that there seems to be evolutionary purposes out there that demand to be manifested, and they find founders and people to make them happen. Now, of course, the reality is that in the process, a lot of the founders, you know, at some point, or the leaders of the organizations, fall for traditional management, and they stop listening to that evolutionary purpose, and then just, you know, get the organization in a whole different direction. But I believe that sort of this spark, you know, is always there at the beginning, and is always still ready to be there if you're willing to listen to it. And that opens up the question, you know, but if we really listen to this, what might the evolutionary purpose of an organization say? Why might they want to take an organization? And you know, every once in a while I have leaders of large organizations who make, come all the way to Ithaca, to this eco village where I live, to have a conversation with me. And there were two conversations that, you know, stood out in this way for me. One was a group of CEOs of fashion firm. So, you know, think sort of fast clothing on high street. So the equivalents of H&M or Zara or these kind of things. And they went on an exercise to start to listen. And what came out of there was a very beautiful purpose. And that was to go for zero waste. And in their opinion, zero waste meant, you know, not only material waste, but also not wasting people's energy or people's creativity in these organizations where, you know, often people in stores, you know, have very little to say. It also meant, you know, not wasting stuff on discount, so not producing too much and then having to discount it or to throw it away. I mean, so, and it of course meant, you know, a whole different environmental perspective. And so, you know, what a beautiful perspective came out of there, which was so at odds with the, you know, fast fashion perspective that, you know, traditional organizations go for. Or had a conversation with an operator of malls, so shopping malls. And he just had this amazing, beautiful vision. I'm smiling because just as I'm looking out of the window, I have an amazing, beautiful vision of a little squirrel that is sitting there and looking at me. So he had this amazing, beautiful vision of, you know, saying that we can't continue doing shopping malls just as these temples of consumption. That makes no sense. But what if these places could become meeting places, almost like, you know, traditional squares in old town villages where people come together? Well, we have this infrastructure. How could this infrastructure serve as a place of meeting and relationship and community building? And wow, that was just such a beautiful purpose that came through him. And in many ways, I noticed just from seeing what people are busy with that, you know, there seem to be these big patterns that come out in terms of where evolutionary purposes wants to take organizations. If I'm thinking about schools, I mean, all the people who seem to be in touch with a deeper purpose for schools all seem to go in a direction that children become actors of their own learning, that they become self-directed in their own learning. When you look in terms of agriculture, you know, there's this whole movement of permaculture and regenerative agriculture, of actually listening to the soil and actually listening to, you know, what is possible and wanting to grow rather than imposing something onto the soil. In the field of justice, it's everything has to do with regenerative justice and conscious contracting. And in healthcare, I mean, there's this whole movement that finally recognizes the value of relationships and a holistic perspective on healthcare. And as I was thinking about all of these examples, I think what they all have in common is a fundamental switch from the metaphor of everything is a machine. So, you know, schools are factories and, you know, that just churn out children that are molded in the same way. And the body is a machine. And so doctors just look at the body in the machine. And agriculture looks at the soil, you know, from a machine perspective. And, you know, there's like inputs and outputs and you know, fertilizers and all of that. And the justice system. So everything, you know, is a machine in modernity. And it seems like in all of these fields, we're making the leap to look at things as living systems. You know, just as I talk about for management in reinventing organizations, but it seems to happen in all of these fields. So we seem to be at this really interesting historical juncture where every time we listen, it seems like the evolutionary purpose that speaks to us is asking us to make that leap from a metaphor of the world as a machine to the metaphor of the world as a living organism. And, you know, sometimes I sometimes am daunted by, you know, the times we live in and this historical shift that we need to make and all of these multiple crises that we face. And when I think of evolutionary purpose, that feels to me like something where I suddenly go like, whew, you know, it doesn't need to be daunting. You know, it's not like we have to forcefully try to solve these problems, because every time we listen, it sounds like, you know, something is speaking to us about what's needed. Something is speaking to us about this new world that wants to emerge, that wants to, you know, heal the shadows of modernity and, you know, usher us into the next phase. And so that's really what I'm talking about when I'm talking about evolutionary purpose. So it's, you know, it's way more than simply having a noble purpose. It's actually aligning with the power of evolution, that big overarching power, or say differently, you know, that subtle voice that speaks to us if we know how to listen. And that, of course, then begs the question, but then, you know, how do you listen? And this is really a field where I feel that we've still got most to learn. I said it in the book. This is really a field where, you know, this, I feel we've only scratched the surface. And I think if we still have so much to learn, it's because some of these practices, you know, border on the esoteric and make some people uncomfortable, right? Sometimes when I speak about this, you know, some people tell, even, you know, who are into stages of development, you know, tell me, oh, but this isn't teal, you know, this is turquoise. And yeah, maybe it is. And so, you know, in the book, I talk about a number of practices, you know, a very simple one, like having an empty chair that, you know, represents the organization or its evolutionary purpose. And, you know, somebody in a meeting simply going to sit in that empty chair and to try to speak, you know, from evolutionary purpose and give it a voice. There's obviously Theory U, you know, talks quite a bit of that, Otto Scharmer's Theory U, right? And with different techniques at the bottom, you know, often it's, you know, nature or, you know, walks in silence, stillness, simply to create that space for, you know, that voice to be heard. I remember experimenting one day. There were like 30 people in a room, and I just out of the blue experimented with a guided visualization. It was really fun. I'm totally not trained to do that. I've never done it before. But I just invited the 30 people in the room to do a guided visualization. They were from all different organizations, and in that guided visualization, I asked, you know, two images to come up. The first image I asked to come up was the organization to reveal its current pain, if there was any pain. And the second image was to reveal an image of a future it aspires for. And it was interesting, even though I, you know, wasn't trained to do this, we had a debrief afterwards, and at some point I asked a show of hand, and, you know, one third of people didn't get anything that would seem to be super interesting, but two thirds of the people said that they got really powerful images of stuff that they didn't quite know before, didn't have words before. Really sort of new images came to them of, you know, the organization sort of speaking to them. A year ago, I stumbled upon an article about the use of constellations in organizations. And, you know, constellations are used quite often, you know, systems, family or systemic constellations. I know that they've been used at the Integra conference. And often it's used to, you know, see, you know, team dynamics or dynamics at level of an executive committee. But here the article talked about something very different. It's a woman from, you know, from Switzerland, who now lives in Italy, called Romy Gerhard, who wrote this article, unfortunately right now only in German, about this family farm that is, you know, so they run a hotel, and they had this project of building a really high-end, beautiful spa resort in the mountains in Austria. And they had been on this project for 6 years, and there was always delays, and nothing was working. I mean, it was just a nightmare. And at some point, they do a constellation, and what they realize is, we have to start again. We have to just do as if we had basically done nothing over the last 6 years and start from scratch. And then they used constellations for every important decision that they made. So a constellation for, you know, which architect are we going to work with, and which construction firm are we going to work with, and what are we called the rooms, and what kind of water are we going to use, and you know, what pricing will we use, and you know, architectural decisions. And I mean, it was amazing. And I, you know, it's hard for me to believe, but I believe them. It took them 1 year between the moment they started again and the moment the first clients came in, which is, I mean, a ridiculously short amount of time. I mean, everything went smoothly, simply because, you know, for every major decision, they weren't so much deciding with their head, they were deciding with their head, but, you know, based on input that they received, you know, from the organization's evolutionary purpose. And so in 1 year, they did 50 constellations, 50 constellations, you know, basically one constellation per week. And I think that opens up the door to a whole new domain of things going so much more smoothly, because we're just constantly given guidance by the organization for what it needs and where it wants to go. It's an amazing story. So that's where I feel that, you know, there's still so much we can learn. I guess another obvious candidate, if you're open for it, if it doesn't sound too esoteric, is simply to do some channeling, you know, with people who are, you know, who are powerful in that domain. But even beyond those techniques, there's something else we can do, and that is simply aligning ourselves with the source. And I want to spend a little bit more time on this. And when I use the word source, that's the word from a person called Peter Koenig, and maybe some of you know him and his work. I stumbled upon him after the book came out, and to my knowledge, he has never really written anything. So he only shares his insights in workshops. But it's powerful stuff, and you know, he's done this, shared this in thousands of workshops, and it seems just to resonate with pretty much everybody. And he talks about the source, and what he means by that is that in every organization, there is a person who seems to have a privileged access to what he calls sort of an information channel that provides guidance to what is needed in the organization. And so that person, he calls that person the source. And you know, it's very obvious to understand in startups. You know, often there's a founder who has a strong vision and just intuitively senses what's needed. Often you see that in, you know, in family firms where you have the patriarch, you know, whose voice just carries weight. And, you know, if the patriarch retires and, you know, installs his son or his daughter, or her, you know, her son or her daughter, you sometimes then have this phenomenon where, you know, it's still the patriarch, you know, who is the source, and somehow what the daughter or the son says has almost no power, you know. But if the patriarch comes back for lunch one day, you know, everybody will gather around him or her. Because there's just a sense that, you know, he or she, you know, senses, knows what's needed. An obvious example is Apple, right, where Steve Jobs was obviously that person who has access to that source, and when Steve Jobs left, the whole company went rudderless, he came back, and suddenly there was a clear sense of where to go. And what Peter Koenig insists on is that it's important for that person to know when they're speaking from the source, or when they're simply speaking from themselves, like from the ego, we could call it. You know, sometimes you make decisions that don't, you know, aren't informed by the source, but simply, I don't know, we should buy this other company because we'll double in size, you know, and that makes me personally feel good, but that wasn't actually, you know, what intuition told me or what was whispered to me. And so there's a real important work for the source to make that distinction. And what Peter Koenig insists on is that, you know, when people talk from the source, others naturally want to follow that because it's just powerful. So somebody comes to the founder and says, like, here are three possible ideas. And the founder says, you know, it's this one. You know, people then just gravitate. There's energy there, right? So one of the things in self-management, I think, one of the dangers is to say, hey, no one should be the source because we should be all equal. I still believe that even though power is largely shared in the organization, or totally shared, there might still be a person who has that preferred access to the source, and we should totally recognize that. Because, you know, with self-management, that person cannot impose their vision, but they can simply offer what they've heard to the whole organization, and generally, people are extremely happy for somebody to play that role. It's just one role among many others. It doesn't give that person the power of being a CEO. It's just recognizing that one person seems to have sort of this intuition of what's needed. And so in self-managing organizations, you might have, I still believe, one person who might have a closer connection. But what self-management allows is many, many more people to be what Peter Koenig calls subsources. You know, they sense all sorts of things, of initiatives, of projects that are needed, which wasn't possible in a traditional hierarchical organization. And so, you know, we have guided visualizations and constellations and, you know, the empty chair and theory U and channeling, but the way most sensing happens is by simply sensing within on a day-to-day basis, you know, what's called for, and being able to make that distinction between, you know, am I talking from a deeper place? You know, am I giving voice to some intuition, to the evolutionary purpose whispering to me, or is it just my ego speaking, right? And so that, I think, becomes a key capacity for us all to develop as sources or subsources in organizations. And that brings me to the question of courage and integrity, right? If evolutionary purpose is speaking to us, the question becomes, do we have the courage to listen, right? Because it is often inviting us to go quite, you know, far outside of our comfort zone. You know, I'm often thinking about the poor guys or girls who are at the top of you know, organizations that are very destructive these days. I don't know, if imagine you're heading the pesticides and fertilizer business of Monsanto Bayer. You know, if you listen to the evolutionary purpose, I imagine that what comes out of it is to say, hey, you know, your business is destructive. You should close it. You know, you should help a whole new agriculture take shape rather than propping up this old agriculture that is dying and is so incredibly harmful. You know, wow, within the current system, you know, how do you go about that? I'm often dreaming of the day when we'll have leaders who will lobby governments, not for less regulation, but for more regulation, saying, I sense that this is the direction we might go into, and please regulate this to force my competitors to do, you know, to do good, and because otherwise I won't be able to do it. You know, I'd love one day to have maybe a CEO who's where people discover that he or she has leaked documents to NGOs to make them ally and put pressure to help them realize their evolutionary purpose. But of course, the question, the invitation, I think, is not just for these big leaders of traditional corporations. It's for all of us. And so my question to you, if you have a break at some point, is to really ponder this question of, in your work, you know, what is evolutionary purpose calling you for? And do you have the courage to listen? Because the disease of our times is, you know, is the business. It's to just keep busy as a tactic to not having to listen to what we're called for, because it might feel scary. And so the key for me is really, do we accept to listen? Do we have the courage to listen? Do we stop the business? And do we then, you know, follow the calling? And what's interesting to me is when I spoke with some people who I found, you know, have had amazing courage in you know, following their calling, almost all of them tell me oh no, that wasn't a question of courage for me. And I mean, what do you mean? And they said, like, there was no other option. And so I think, you know, courage is just the flip side of integrity, right? If we dare to listen, if we really dare to listen, then at some point there is no choice but to follow what, you know, what we're meant to do, what we're called to do. But the first step is, you know, simply having the courage to listen. So the courage, I think, is much more in the beginning, in the listening, than it's in the end, in the doing. Like, once you've listened and you've let this, you know, go through your system, there's a moment where you naturally, you know, go into action. So that's what I wanted to share with you today. I hope that I've been able to convey that evolutionary purpose is something truly powerful. That it's, you know, it's not simply having, you know, a nice sounding mission statement or just a noble purpose like so many organizations have. I really believe that listening to evolutionary purpose, you know, is the key to changing the world, or maybe more appropriately, is the key to listening to how the world asks to be changed.